This is an ABC podcast.
An Australian jihadist is on death row in Iraq for being part of the Islamic State group. Who cries for such a man? And why aren't opponents of capital punishment pushing his cause? And an African-American Orthodox rabbi challenges the stereotype of what it is to be Jewish. Hello, Andrew West, bringing you the Religion and Ethics Report. Let's go straight to Hong Kong, where protests are continuing. The trigger for the 2 million strong rallies over the past 10 days is a proposed law to allow the extradition of prisoners from Hong Kong to mainland China. But there is a broader democratic agenda, and religious freedom is a big part of it. Kirsty Needham is China correspondent for the Sydney Morning Herald and The Age, and she joins us from Hong Kong. Kirsty, welcome. How much of the leadership of the protests has been coming from religious figures?
Look, this influence is actually quite widespread when you scratch the surface. One thing I should clarify, though, unlike the Occupy Central and the Umbrella Movement of 2014, which had quite clear leaders and founders, many of whom were recently jailed after belated government prosecutions for their role in organising that democracy movement, this time the opposition to the extradition bill and the massive protests that we've seen on the streets, 1 million and then 2 million the next week coming out, is very widespread amongst the community. It's drawn from different sectors, but we can certainly say that Christian groups, particularly the Catholic Church and Methodist and Baptist groups, are quite prominent in organising this and participating out there on the street. And I guess the most obvious sign of this is that the anthem of the protest movement is Sing Hallelujah to the Lord. So the Tuesday before the Legislative Council were due to meet to start debate on this bill, that debate was suspended when tens of thousands of young people surrounded the building. But on that Tuesday evening, church groups and church choirs were coming out and just repeatedly singing Hallelujah to the Lord. And that continued right through to the next day until everyone was dispelled by tear gas and rubber bullets.
Yeah. What is the basis then of these religious leaders mobilising many of their congregations or many of their followers against this extradition law?
They see it as a very direct threat to the operation of missionaries that go into China from Hong Kong, but also in the long term, Hong Kong's right to religious freedom. It was explained to me that Hong Kong is a very religious city, and the reason for this is that when the communists took over in 1949 and Shanghai was evacuated, a lot of the Shanghai elite were very strong Christians. They came across to Hong Kong and, you know, provided the economic basis for the global financial powerhouse that we see now. And so right throughout, not just the clergy themselves, but lawmakers, judges, right throughout the Hong Kong elite and throughout the school system, there's a very strong Christian faith there, and they do see the encroachment of Beijing in recent years trying to change laws and very directly with this extradition bill as a threat to their right to go to church and to practice their faith.
Kirsty, one of the fascinating things in your very extensive and interesting reportage on this has been the very fact that one of the most prominent Christians in this whole confrontation is the chief executive herself, Carrie Lam. She is a practicing Catholic. Now, has she felt or manifested any sense of being torn between both her religious faith and what is seen to be her, you know, over-reliance or excessive loyalty to Beijing?
This is really fascinating. So yes, Carrie Lam is a parishioner in the Catholic Wan Chai parish. She actually didn't become a Communist Party member, even though she's chief executive of the Hong Kong Special Administrative Region of China, because she would have to renounce her Catholic faith. She didn't do that. And another interesting point is on Monday, the day after 2 million people had taken over the streets of Hong Kong to demand that she withdraw this extradition bill and that she, you know, change her labelling of last Wednesday's protest as a riot, she met with six religious leaders, including John Tong, the Catholic cardinal, and another quite liberal Catholic bishop. We don't know what was said, but it's very interesting that she sought to speak to these religious leaders before going public the next day on Tuesday and addressing the media.
And some of those Catholic leaders themselves, I think, are experiencing some sense of divided loyalty, as it were, because, as you well know, the Vatican has been trying to essentially cut a deal with Beijing to allow more access for the Catholic Church to mainland China. What's the tension there?
Yes, this is very concerning to the Catholic Church in Hong Kong. So we've seen this manifest in a number of ways. Earlier this year, the existing cardinal passed away, and acting Cardinal John Tong was appointed to replace him. But more liberal-leaning bishops were overlooked, Joseph Ha and others. Joseph Ha has been one that has been down talking to student protesters outside of Carrie Lam's office this week, praying with them and, you know, asking them to keep the tensions down. They don't want to see any more violence with police. But retired Cardinal Joseph Zen is a very prominent figure, I guess, in the democracy movement, but also in really pushing back against the Vatican's move to re-establish relationships with Beijing. And the concern there is that they feel that the underground Catholic Church in mainland China would be let down, and they feel there's a threat to the safety of the work of some of the missionaries there.
Great to talk to you. Kirsty Needham, Age and Sydney Morning Herald correspondent in China. She's currently in Hong Kong doing some great reporting there. Kirsty, thanks for being with us on the program.
Thank you, Andrew.
And this is the Religion and Ethics Report. Australian jihadi Ahmed Merhi evokes little sympathy. The one-time labourer was captured in Iraq last year after fighting with the extremist group Islamic State. Now he's been sentenced to death by an Iraqi court. But a leading security analyst says his case poses a key ethical question. Should the Australian government oppose the death penalty even for the worst cases? I explored the Merhi case with the Lowy Institute's Roger Shanahan.
Ahmed Merhi is an Australian who went over to Syria or Iraq. We're not sure exactly how he entered. Around 2014, he was a fighter for Islamic State, and he was an active recruiter for other Australians to travel over. A couple of his family members have also been arrested in Australia for providing financial support to Islamic State through Ahmed Merhi. As far as we're aware, he was wounded in an airstrike at some stage during the fighting, where he has lost part of one leg. He and another fighter, a Lebanese man who has Australian relatives as well, were captured. They claim that they were captured in Syria and transported over to Iraq, but it's not certain whether that was the case. But they were put on trial in court in Iraq and have been sentenced to death. Mm. And he has appealed that sentence, and that appeal has not been heard, and it's not likely to be heard for a period of time.
What is pretty clear, though, Roger, is that Ahmed Merhi is an extremist. He has a record, as you've pointed out, of trying to recruit Australians to Islamic State. So he's part of what, a broader network? Do we know anything about that?
Well, the way that Australians travelled over to Syria and Iraq with Islamic State was a relatively disaggregated way. So there were a couple of facilitators, Australian facilitators in Australia or some Australians overseas, who would then try and aid the passage of other fighters to travel normally through Turkey and then into Syria. Ahmed Merhi was one of those who was trying to recruit and then to facilitate the entry of other fighters through Turkey into Syria. So he was part of what we probably term a relatively loose network of Australian foreign fighters.
So what were the specific offences that have basically landed him on death row in Iraq?
Well, in Iraq, it's sufficient just to prove that you're a member of a terrorist organisation like Islamic State. So regardless of what your function was within that, simply being a member of a terrorist organisation brings with it the death penalty. So the judge is entirely within their rights, according to Islamic law, that if he or she is satisfied that the person's a member of Islamic State, they can give them the death penalty. And that is the case with Ahmed Merhi. They proved to their satisfaction that he was a member of Islamic State, and it doesn't go much further than that. From what we know of these trials, they're quite perfunctory, given the huge numbers that the Iraqi government is dealing with. So if you're seen to be a fighter with Islamic State, many, many have been given the death penalty, a few others have been given life imprisonment, but the degree of involvement with the organisation appears to be less important than the fact that you were a member of the organisation.
You're pretty unambiguous in the way that you very clearly acknowledge that Ahmed Murhi is not an especially savoury character. Why then have you said that the Australian government needs to be doing much more to spare him the death penalty?
What I'm arguing is that there are anti-death penalty advocates who were very vocal regarding the Bali Nine concerts in Australia, artists advancing their cause, human rights commissioners saying that the death penalty should not be given to anybody. And here's a very unsavoury terrorist who's an Australian citizen who's been sentenced to death in Iraq, but yet we hear nothing from anti-death penalty advocates. The point I was trying to make was, if you are an anti-death penalty advocate, then why aren't you standing up for somebody like Ahmed Murhi? I'm not necessarily saying that he shouldn't face the death penalty. What I'm saying is that he is a classic example of somebody who, on the face of it, deserves the death penalty, but the anti-death penalty advocates should be as vociferous in their support for him as they were for, say, the Bali Nine.
Well, I guess this is the real test, isn't it, Roger? That if you do oppose the death penalty, you must oppose it in all cases, including cases such as this accused Australian terrorist.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wrote about it just because I think it's a very good debate around ethics that we should have, and we're not really hearing anything about it. It raises probably two questions. One, that issue about should the death penalty be allowed. And personally, I'm quite anti the death penalty, but I can see in a very narrow range of circumstances where it may be appropriate, and trying to overthrow governments, trying to subjugate peoples and doing all of those kind of things that Islamic State carried out, being a member of that organisation is probably within that narrow band that I would support the death penalty being implemented. But if you're an anti-death penalty advocate, as you pointed out, it's an all or nothing. You have to protest against it being imposed on any Australian citizen. And it probably doesn't get much harder to try and argue against the death penalty than it does for somebody like Ahmed Murhi. But yet we're hearing nothing.
Why do you think that is? Why do we only hear really imprecise language about his fate?
Yeah, I mean, it's not only for us, but it's also thrown up issues for countries like France, for instance. A few weeks ago, it was either 11 or 14 French citizens were handed over who had been captured in Syrian territory and then were transferred to Iraq to be tried in Iraq. And a number of them have been also been given the death penalty. And the words that came out of the French foreign ministry were saying essentially that they don't support the death penalty, but they acknowledge the sovereignty of Iraq. So again, a very, very soft way of protesting, if you want, from a country that is normally quite upfront about protesting the imposition of the death penalty on its own citizens. And same from the Australian government, we don't really hear much about Ahmed Murhi. Now, I'll probably just have to say there's also one potential issue, which might be a reason why the Australian government is quiet. We know that people have had their citizenship stripped. Murhi, on the face of it, he's not a dual citizen, but he may be eligible for other citizenship. It is possible that he's no longer an Australian citizen, but again, because of the government secrecy, we have no idea whether he is or not.
Is it possible, because this goes to the core ethical issue that you've raised, for someone like Ahmed Murhi in a war-torn country, a war-scarred country like Iraq, to in fact receive a fair trial that would end up in the death penalty?
Yes, and I mean, that's a very good point that you make, and it's one of the points that probably has been getting some play in the print media, because the Iraqi government does allow foreign journalists to sit in on the trials. And one of the criticisms of the trials is exactly what you said. It's pretty perfunctory. in some cases, you know, 10 minutes or so for the accused to go through before the judge, and then the judge passes sentence. And it is a volume issue. There are thousands of people in the Iraqi court system just for these kind of trials. So as an Australian or the Australian government or Australian advocates, this is about as hard an ethical issue as you can get. And yet nobody appears to be having the debate. I think it's a good ethical debate to have, regardless of which side of the fence that you stand on. But it just doesn't appear to be an issue that anybody wants to grapple with.
That's Roger Shanahan of the Lowy Institute. And you're with Andrew West. 10 years after the end of its long civil war, Sri Lanka returned to the headlines with the church and hotel bombings in April. On this week's edition of Compass on ABC TV on Sunday evening at 6:30, our producer Mudita Dias returns to Sri Lanka to explore the roots of religious tension in the country.
The Bodhubala Sena, also known as the Buddhist Power Force, or BBS, claim Muslims are taking over the country. They envy their business acumen, criticise their high birth rate, and accuse them of funding terrorism.
Take this very, very seriously and check house to house, check must to must, and find out who are living in this country.
Shukri Kasim has first-hand experience of this resentment towards Muslims.
I'm not a Muslim in Sri Lanka. I'm a Sri Lankan Muslim. I was born in Sri Lanka. My mother was born in Sri Lanka. My father was born in Sri Lanka. My grandfather was born in Sri Lanka. My great-grandfather was born in Sri Lanka. So I am as Sri Lankan as anyone is.
The BBS actually represent a kind of a militant wing that represents themselves as the custodians or the saviors. Now, this is nothing to do with the Buddhist philosophy and religion. These are obviously certain fringe groups. I think they have a kind of an ideology per se. It's a kind of reactive policy against people who they believe that they pose a threat to this country, a threat to this culture, a threat to the sovereignty of the people. So they have these whole slogans that go on.
In March 2018, a young Buddhist died during an argument with a group of Muslims. Following the funeral, Buddhist extremists attacked Muslim businesses and homes.
The first call that I got was from a Buddhist friend. He said, there seems to be problems in Kandy. If you feel unsafe, you can go to my place. You're always welcome. There was tension around the area among Muslims. So I saw a mob marching towards our place. They were picking Muslim houses and pelting stones at them. Right in front of my eyes, all the windows and doors were broken. I went inside the garage and set the car on fire. We were all petrified, traumatized. We somehow escaped from the back door of the house and fled away.
I attribute it to nothing to do with the religions. No religion talks about violence. It talks about the economic interest and political interest. Here, what really comes up is end of the colonial period, you find this conflict really coming up. There you find the conflict, the economic conflict with the mercantile sector, especially the Islamic communities, Hindu communities, the Buddhist communities who are now trying to share the spoils of the mercantile culture.
That's part of Sri Lanka Hoping for Harmony, produced by our own Mudita Dias. I strongly recommend it. It's a cracker of a program. It's this Sunday on Compass on ABC TV at 6:30 p.m. Finally today, you don't meet folks like Chase Rishon every day. He wears the prayer shawl and the skull cap of an Orthodox Jewish man. But he has the cadence and the sharp line in suits of a preacher in the black church. Because Chase Rishon is an African-American Orthodox rabbi. His Jewish lineage stretches back almost 300 years. And he was in Australia this week for the Limud Oz Festival of Jewish Ideas, where we caught up.
I'm usually asked about the pseudonym that I write and speak under, which is Manish Chana. So they ask, like, why did you name yourself that? So as someone who speaks on racial and religious identity and how that intersection manifests, particularly around American Judaism, I use Manish Chana as sort of a play on the classic Passover Seder question, Manish Chana Halayla Hazeh, what makes this night so different from all other nights? But the question I'm really asking is, like, what makes this Jew so different from other Jews? Mm.
And what is the answer to that question?
Everything and nothing.
Mm. Yeah, because, for example, you do not come from a short sort of Jewish history.
As far as I know, my ancestors on my mother's side came here as Jewish Africans in the 1780s, not here, to the States. But an interesting question that I get when I say that is, like, so when did they become Jewish? Which to me is a weird and strange question, because it's like there's blackness and then somehow Jewishness got in, as opposed to people who sort of quote unquote look Jewish and they say, oh, my family was Jewish since this, and they're like, oh, where did they come from? As opposed to, when did they become Jewish? So that's always interesting.
Yeah. You would seem to me, and correct me if I'm wrong, to embody one of the central questions in the Jewish world today, Rabbi, and that is, what does it mean to be Jewish? Is it a religion? Is it an ethnicity? Or is it an identity that's just all-encompassing?
Yes. The way I typically like to describe Judaism is as a family. Because you have, like, that sort of genetic base of a family, but then you have people that marry in, and, like, their spouses are now part of that family, even if they're not genetically connected. You can adopt people in, so they have really no connection, like, genetically, but they're still a part of that family. And that's really how I like to sort of describe it. That's Judaism. I'm sure there's that Levantine genetic base, you know, from 12 tribes on, but people can marry it in and convert and be adopted and re-raised in it. And so it's really, it's all of those things. Like, people that really struggle with, is Judaism a religion or not, are really looking at it from that sort of Christian perspective of there being religions, where Judaism reaches back to that sort of tradition of sort of peoples, where you have, you know, tribes and, like, Angles and Jutes and Sakons, if we're talking, like, Germanically, which is, I'm not sure why that's the first thing that popped in my head, probably because I'm an English major. So, like, it's like Beowulf hopped in there just now. But it's that same sort of concept where Judaism, it's not even a religion, really. It's a way of life. It's a way to, you know, what do you do when you get up in the morning? What shoe do you put on before this shoe? What do you eat? How do you conduct yourself in life? That's more than a religion. It's all encompassing.
I think I recall from my history studies that Dr. King said that the most segregated hour in American life was 11 o'clock on a Sunday morning. Now, he was speaking of Christians who should look across the colour line. In the American Jewish community, 6 million strong, is the most segregated hour, what, 6 o'clock on a Friday evening still?
I would say no, but not, I think, for the reason that it works in Dr. King's analogy, because in that space, in this conception, there are white churches and black churches. So for Jews of color, there aren't really, like, Jew of color synagogues. We're sort of interspersed and sprinkled into sort of mainstream white Ashkenazi spaces and places. But there definitely was, at least in America, a sort of intentional segregation. If you look at some early American constitutions, there are constitutional laws saying they'll accept members provided he, she, or they are not people of color, or stating that this is a congregation for the white Israelites of the city. So American Jews definitely had the capacity and acted on being as just as segregated as their white Christian counterparts. But there's not sort of that hour of segregation in the same way that exists in Christianity, because there wasn't ever really a chance for there to be a cohesive, identifiable community of Jews of color, at least when it comes to African Americans.
How are African American Jews, and you've spoken about some of the challenges of being received in the white Jewish community, received in the black community?
It varies, but by and large, at least in my experience and what I've noticed, African-American Jews are more accepted in African-American spaces than they are in Jewish spaces. Like growing up in Crown Heights in New York, I experienced far more racism in Jewish spaces than I ever did anti-Semitism in African-American spaces. And I think that speaks to the difference between white anti-Semitism and black anti-Semitism.
And we should just remind the listeners, Rabbi, that Crown Heights, I think in the 1990s, was the scene of some terrible interracial violence. It's also fed by, I guess, a sort of history of tension that really grew out of what was once a very strong African-American Jewish unity ticket, as it were. We think of people like Rabbi Abraham Joshua Heschel, right there side by side with Dr. King and the other civil rights leaders. What has happened to that union, that partnership, as it were?
One, that partnership has been highly romanticized for the past 60 years. It was not nearly as, you know, sort of harmonious or strong as portrayed. Its height was maybe the Freedom Summers, but even in that relationship as was happening, it was sort of a paternal, patronizing sort of relationship. Like, oh, us as Jews, we're going to help these poor African Americans. It wasn't ever really a unified, equally invested sort of relationship. Secondarily, nothing has really happened since then. So what happened to it is people have just pointed to that one picture of Heschel and King and just continuously cashed out of that account, but never put anything back into it. So, and it's been the past 60 years.
Just finally, there's a big debate in the American Jewish diaspora about relationship, attitude to Israel. African-American Jews, are they part of this debate, and are they similarly divided in their attitudes to Israel?
The African-American-Jewish relationship with Israel is, I'll say, nuanced. I mean, there are Zionist African-American Jews, there are non-Zionist African-American Jews. The problem is the African-American-Jewish involvement in the Israel conversation is highly racialized in the reaction to it. If you have someone African-American and Jewish who's not particularly Zionist, it's like, oh, well, you should, you know better or be more empathetic because, you know, you went through slavery, where it's sort of a removal of their Judaism, saying, well, you're just black, so you should get it. You know, you're not really being, you know, Jewish. And on the other side, if you're African-American and Zionists, it's like, well, how could you be that? So it's like getting ready for your
blackness. What about your Palestinian brothers?
Exactly. Yeah. And the attacks from whatever opposing side are always sort of racially based as opposed to ideologically.
That's African-American Orthodox Rabbi Chase Rishon. And we'll bring you more interviews from the Limud Oz Festival in coming weeks. And that is the show for this week. Subscribe to the Religion and Ethics Report at the ABC Listen app or iTunes. And also subscribe to the newsletter. Just go to abc.net.au/religion and subscribe at the bottom of the page. Thanks to Muta Tadias and Bryce Halliday. I'm Andrew West, back next week.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.